Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm so happy. I have my Alex today. It is me and Alex. We haven't done one in so long, and I'm so excited to get rocking and rolling with that Alex talk to us.
You're also happy because we're in World War II today as well, which is why you're like bouncing off your office walls right now.
Two for one.
Today we have, and we've been trying to get this one together for a while, and finally all the tech demons have gone away, and we have with us Philip Cracknell, who's a historian and battlefield guide. His thing is Hong Kong during the Second World War. He's written a book called The Battle of Hong Kong now, but he's got a new one out which is called The Occupation of Hong Kong, and this is brilliant for me. Hello, Philip.
Hi.
But I'm excited because we very often don't head east, do we, Alex?
No, we don't. We don't do enough Far East stuff. We usually just grovel at the feet of Rich Frank or James Scott. So this is really exciting. So I think maybe before we do anything else, should we ask you, Philip, tell us about Hong Kong before the war arrives in Hong Kong. What does it look like? How does it operate?
Okay, in December 1941... when the war broke out, Hong Kong had been under threat from the Japanese Empire for quite some years. Hong Kong was not at war. So the lights were on, the restaurants were full, the theatres were full. And yet over in UK, the war had been on since September 1939. So Hong Kong was a kind of slightly unreal place. Yes, the country was at war, but so far it hadn't affected Hong Kong. But Japanese army was just across the border and had been threatening Hong Kong since really about 1938.
Okay, so we talk about the battle for Hong Kong then, because it's often overshadowed, I think, by Singapore, isn't it? But it was hotly contested. So how did it play out?
Singapore was considered by the British as the impregnable fortress. It was like the Gibraltar of Asia. And when Singapore surrendered in February 1942, the army that surrendered was an army of 80,000 men, British, Australian, Indian, a variety of troops, Malayan, volunteers from Singapore and Malaya. And they surrendered to a Japanese army of 35,000 men. So they surrendered to a much smaller army who had outfought them, outmaneuvered them. And of course, I'm sure the British garrison had no idea that they were surrendering to such a small force. In Hong Kong, it was the other way around. Hong Kong was an expected defeat. It had become a strategic liability. It was seen as an isolated outpost. It wasn't expected for one moment that it could defend itself against the Japanese army. Whereas Singapore, it was the other way around. So Singapore, an unexpected defeat. Churchill described it as the worst catastrophe in British military history, the biggest capitulation in British history.
I'm really interested in the experiences of those who are actually fighting the battle. I mean, at one point you would think they would be successful, but were they truly successful or not?
I guess not, because the battle was lost. But they were successful in the sense that they put up a good fight. They lasted out for a long time. Churchill looked at Hong Kong and described Hong Kong as having not the faintest chance of being able to defend itself or of being relieved if attacked by the Japanese. So Churchill had effectively written off Hong Kong. Did they fight well? Yes. I mean, they were, as I mentioned earlier, a smaller garrison facing a much larger army. Because Hong Kong had effectively been written off, it had a paucity of aircraft, of naval assets, of manning, of equipment, of anti-aircraft guns, of howitzers. Everything was in short supply because Hong Kong was not a priority.
The people on the ground, do they see themselves as not a priority, though? I'm guessing no.
No, I think the answer is no. I mean, if they were, they would have completely destroyed morale if they knew how Churchill saw Hong Kong. In other words, you know, their chance of being defended or relieved. So I don't think they felt that, but they must have realised that they had very few aircraft. I mean, the RAF in Hong Kong was really like almost a joke. There were only five aircraft, and they were all biplanes. Three of them were torpedo bombers. Two of them were reconnaissance flying boats. The two flying boats were they were called walruses, walrus flying boats. They were normally catapulted off a warship, used for reconnaissance ahead of the fleet, and then brought back and lifted up onto the ship by a crane. So absolutely no use against modern Japanese fighters. And when on Monday, the 8th of December, when the Japanese did attack Hong Kong, the first thing to happen was a massive attack involving more than 30 Japanese aircraft on Kai Tak.
And those the day after Pearl Harbor?
It was actually almost simultaneous.
Oh, wow. So they mounted two big operations like that. Sorry, I'm so ignorant of the Far East in the Second World War. So they mounted two operations like that at the same time?
They did. In fact, more, because they attacked the Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, the naval base at Hawaii and various islands in the Pacific, all more or less simultaneously. But the reason why I say Monday, the 8th of December for Hong Kong and the Pearl Harbor was attacked on the 7th is because between Hong Kong and Hawaii, you have the international dateline. So, so the Americans all think the war began on the 7th with the attack on Pearl Harbor. In Britain, we talk about the Pacific War beginning on Monday, the 8th of December. And it was only the day before that, on Sunday, the 7th of December, that mobilization began, and the troops went to their battle stations. So if we go back to that Sunday, the 7th of December, the military commander, Major General Maltby, was sitting in St. John's Cathedral in Hong Kong, having just read the lesson, he returned to his pew. And then while he's sitting there, an orderly comes into the church, his footsteps heavily resonating on the stone floor of the cathedral. A whispered conversation takes place. The military commander, Major General Maltby, leaves the church cathedral. A meeting of the Defence Council is convened. And following that, a state of emergency is declared and the troops go to their war stations. Next morning, Monday, 8th of December, 8 o'clock in the morning, Kai Tak is attacked. And shortly after that, the Japanese army crossed the border from China into Hong Kong.
So Hong Kong falls. We're going to leave that there because that's another book. This book is about the occupation. Alina, and no, the first thing Alina's going to want to talk about is civilians and civilian experience.
Okay. She knows me way too well.
I don't like the military stuff in the war. It bores me. Talk to me about the people. Go on.
It's true. I mean, it's like the people are being murdered. You've got the murders of prisoners, nurses, civilians, and it all happens straight away. Are these acts orders for example, in the case of officers not being able to control their men, or is there a deeper meaning behind it?
I think the Japanese army was a very brutal army. They were very brutal to their own men. They had a history of brutality in their operations in China. They would use captured prisoners for bayoneting practice. So I think some of it was an institutionalized brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they were direct orders. And there were also customs. I mean, for example, the Japanese in the battle for Hong Kong, almost never, I think maybe there are two exceptions, but almost never took prisoners who couldn't walk. So if you were non-walking wounded, you were going to be put to death. And that would be done quite brutally, not even with the courtesy of a bullet, very often with bayonets or beating with rifle butts. So the Japanese did not, you know, pick up wounded prisoners and carry them out on stretchers. They didn't even treat their own wounded very well. And you're absolutely right. The atrocities started pretty quickly. And that included the killing and raping of European and Chinese nurses in hospitals.
Can I just throw something in here really quickly? I mean, this is something that we talk about very often. Actually, we don't talk about it very often, but within my circles, we do. For example, the way the Soviets treated Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians, Eastern Europeans, and Central Europeans, and obviously how the Germans treated their prisoners of war and civilians and everything. We don't talk about how the Japanese treated the Chinese, the Koreans, the Singaporeans. I think that's the right way grammatically of saying it, but we just don't talk about this, and it's so utterly horrific and so utterly brutal. If you think that the Soviets and the Germans were bad, because they were, I'm not saying they weren't, they were, this is just the next level, and it's just beyond horrific.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And you know, I mean, like the battle in Hong Kong only lasted 3 weeks. The first week was fighting in the mainland. And at that point, prisoners were treated quite well, but not many had been taken.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as the Japanese army invaded the island of Hong Kong, right through to Christmas Day, it was atrocity after atrocity. I mean, the most famous case, I suppose, is probably the hospital at St. Stephen's College, Stanley. St. Stephen's College was seen as the Eton of the East. And in fact, it's only about a kilometre from where I'm sitting talking to you right now. And the college the college main school building had been turned into a temporary military hospital. And so there were European and Chinese nurses, there were military orderlies, and there were a lot of patients who had been wounded in the battle. And hospitalized. And, you know, one of the cases, talking about individual cases, one of the cases I really kind of, well, maybe like is the wrong word, but stands out, is that of a chap called Sergeant Major Tuti Beg, who was wounded but managed to swim from Repulse Bay to Stanley, which is a hell of a distance, came ashore, badly lacerated, wounded as well. And he's admitted to the hospital at St. Stephen's College. He's a bit surprised to find his wife, Eileen Begg, is working at the hospital. He thought she, being a military nurse,
yeah,
he knew she was nursing, but he thought she was at the main military hospital on Burn Road. Anyway, it's Christmas Eve, it's the 24th of December, and the fighting at Stanley has really intensified. Close quarter fighting happening all through the night. And the next morning, the Japanese broke into the hospital and ran amok using bayonets to kill patients in their beds and also bayoneting medical orderlies. Eileen Begg helps her husband get out of the bed, helps him hide under the bed, under the mattress, and clambers under the bed with him. And although she died, he can still remember or still remembered and described it in an affidavit for war crimes trials after the war. He can remember the bayonet coming through the mattress and appearing just above their heads. And then his wife, Eileen, a very attractive lady, was one of seven European nurses working at that hospital, one of five who were raped. And of the five that were raped, she was one of three who were raped, mutilated, and killed.
I want to hope that this level of brutality could not continue long term. So Hong Kong has fallen. It's now occupied by the Japanese. What's the immediate aftermath like? When does this taper off? Please, God, tell me it does. And what does the beginning of occupation look like?
The beginning of occupation, starts on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. By this time, to use a hackneyed expression, the enemy were at the gates. The Japanese troops were within, a short distance of the central, the main town, which was called Victoria in those days. The major general in charge of the British troops in Hong Kong had asked the commander in charge of troops on the North Shore, how long can you hold your existing front line? And the answer came back 1 hour. So the decision to surrender was made. And very quickly, troops were disarmed, ordered to return to barracks. The Navy returned to the Royal Navy dockyard. The Army returned to the main barracks in Victoria. Civilians generally remained where they were. Most civilians, obviously fall into a few categories. You have British, American, and Dutch civilians, mm-hmm. Women and children, and men who were older than the combatant age. These people were working as nurses, working in civil defense, like air raid precautions, demolition corps, food control. So all of these civilians had some kind of role they were involved in. And then, of course, there were the Chinese. The Chinese made up about 98% of the population. And they were probably worsely treated by the Japanese than even the British, American, and Dutch, the so-called enemy civilians. And then there were a group known as Third Nationals. These were Portuguese. They were sort of countries that weren't hostile to Japan, like Britain, Holland, and America.
Yeah.
But they weren't Chinese, so hence they were called Third Nationals.
People most likely would have been sent to an internment camp, am I correct?
They were. The civilians, again, American, British, and Dutch, were sent to an internment camp, but not initially. Initially, they didn't know what to do with them. I mean, there were a lot of them. There were about 3,000 of them, men, women, and children. So they stayed where they were for about 10 days. Where they were meant the hospitals they were working in, the food control offices or other offices that they were carrying out their civil defense duties at. And then on the 5th of January, 1942, the order is given that all enemy civilians must report to a parade ground in the heart of Victoria City, Hong Kong. So they turn up, the Japanese are overwhelmed by the number. So instead of registering them and taking all their details, they just gather them into groups of about 200 and march them down to the western part of town. And they're put into short stay hotels, which were really nothing more than brothels. They were dirty, they were vermin infested, and they were crowded into these short-term hotels. you know, like these hotels don't have even rooms. They have cubicles. They're normally 4 or 5 stories with balconies front and back on each floor. They're dark and dingy inside. They're infested with rats. The cubicles have one bed, one sort of old-fashioned type of wash basin, an armchair, and 5 or 6 people would be put into these cubicles. So some had to sleep on the floor. You know, only 1 or 2 would fit on the bed. So pretty miserable conditions, starvation rations, hardly any food is provided. And they remained there until the 21st of January. From the 21st of January, they start moving the civilians to Stanley internment camp. And the as for the military, they've already been moved to prisoner of war camps. They were moved on the 30th of December.
What does Stanley internment camp look like when they arrive?
It's Stanley is a peninsula. And the main features on it are Stanley Prison and St. Stephen's College, the so-called Eton of the East. The prison is a modern prison built in the late 1930s, and that was not used as an internment camp. That was continued to be a Japanese prison. But the rest of the prison compound consisted of accommodation for the prison wardens and their families. And these were used to house or to billet the civilian internees. And likewise, all the buildings in St. Stephen's College were also used to billet internees. So they were put into kind of modern concrete buildings, bungalows, a school, staff bungalows in the school science laboratory, the classroom blocks. But they're crowded into these buildings. Male and female mixed together, children with grown-ups, strangers, many of them are complete strangers to each other. Many of them have nowhere to sleep other than the concrete floor or the wooden floor of their billet. And again, the food that's provided is woefully short. I mean, in the first few months of internment, the calories per day were something like 1,300, 1,400. So, you know, this is a kind of slow starvation diet. In kind of reasonable conditions, but, you know, a large number sleeping on the floor. And, you know, as the worst thing was the overcrowding and, of course, the confinement.
Someone who gets 1,300 calories a day, in theory, with good nutrition, can survive. However, I'm assuming this was very low quality food with absolutely...
Is that not what they basically tell you to eat if you're on like a, you really want to lose weight? That's roughly what Weight Watchers or Slimming World or whatever will try and get you to do about 1,300 calories a day, but good calories, like you say.
Yeah, exactly. So things like avocados and fresh vegetables and fruit and all this kind of stuff. The only reason I'm bringing this up is because also the prisoners in concentration camps and things were also put on such good calorie, I'll say this in quotation marks, nobody can see me, but quotation marks, good calorie diets. But this was such bad quality food that there's no nutritional value. You don't have the vitamins and the minerals and everything else that you actually need every day, which again brings about starvation. And I find that very interesting. But just to add to this, I want to know a little bit more about what their typical day looked like. I mean, what did they have to do? Did they go to work? Did they have to get up? How did it look? Could they write letters? What was possible in this camp?
They couldn't write letters for quite a while. I can't quite remember when they were allowed to write letters, but probably 18 months after they were interned. And likewise, they weren't receiving letters until quite a long time after they'd been interned. And when they did receive letters, they were often a year out of date. The day started with roll call. Most of the, I mean, like, we were talking about the diet just now. I mean, like, for them, breakfast would be rice.
Yeah.
And maybe a watery vegetables. The 2 meals a day, breakfast and the sort of evening meal. And very lucky if they had any meat at all. So malnutrition became rampant. People suffered from beriberi, from pellagra, and various malnutrition related illnesses.
Well, this is
illnesses.
The thing, like, you get the massive decline in dental health, wouldn't you? And it would just be a knock on sort of reduced immune systems.
Disease.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. The lucky ones were the ones that had brought money with them. But there were a lot who had nothing on them apart from what they were wearing. So those who had money or jewellery, at least they could trade on the black market and buy additional food or buy cigarettes. Cigarettes became a kind of common currency. So you could have your haircut and pay for your haircut with cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
There were within the camp, I'm probably jumping to one of your questions, but there were people within the camp who were kind of doing the black market trading, so-called king rats. And these black market traders were very unpopular because they were profiteering and benefiting from the difficult conditions that people found themselves in. So, you know, women were selling their jewelry, their wedding rings, things that, you know, meant a lot to them and they didn't want to give up. People were also asking the dentist to remove their gold fillings or gold teeth because they could be sold through black market. Watches were sold, Parker pens were sold. Watches, basically kind of cash jewelry watches. The black market traders, although they were condemned by many, it was also appreciated by most that had it not been for them, many would have become very ill, suffered ill health, very serious ill health, or even it could make the difference between life and death. So they were kind of despised, but also it was realized that what they were doing, they were taking a big risk as well by trading with the guards. But what they were doing did actually help people survive.
So they're internees as well, who just, I guess, have the savvy to get in with the guards and start getting stuff bought in. That's how they managed to place themselves like on an elevated level within the camp hierarchy.
Correct, yeah. And some of them are women, some of them are men. They had their own contacts amongst the guards. The Japanese were harder to work through than, for example, the Formosan guards. The Formosans, Formosa obviously is, I'm sure everybody knows, is present-day Taiwan, and the Formosans spoke Chinese. And there were quite a number of Chinese internees. I know that sounds odd because I mentioned enemy aliens, British, American, Dutch, but the Chinese wives of enemy civilians had a choice of either going in with their husbands and possibly their children or remaining out of camp. But if they remained out of camp in occupied Hong Kong, the question was, how would they make money? How would they feed themselves? But there were some that decided to remain out in order to try and protect their property, their home. And many of them, if their home hadn't been looted, and most homes were looted during the battle, if their home hadn't been looted, they could only exist by selling their furniture in order to raise money to buy food, and in particular rice.
I think Alina's just waiting for some sound to die out.
Oh, okay. I could see her eyes.
No. There's a dog barking. I don't know if you guys can hear it when I'm
talking. No, we're good. We can't hear it, so you can go.
Interestingly, talking about dogs, some people brought dogs in Stanley Camp. It's surprising in a way that the Japanese allowed that. Some people managed to get hold of chickens that, you know, if they were coupled with a male bird, could produce eggs. You'd think that a dog's life would be pretty dangerous. I mean, the same thing happened in POW camp. Some of the officers brought in dogs, including the military commander, Major General Maltby. But I believe some of the dogs disappeared.
Yeah. Oh, no, don't tell Alina that. No, she's broken now. Quick, change the subject, Alina.
I'm changing the subject very quickly to something, because obviously a lot of people in the camp, they spoke Chinese. They had lived in Hong Kong and things like that. So escape, I'm saying this in theory, because coming from my own experience on working from things like this, in theory, escape beyond the camp should have been easy. So were there any escape attempts or any repatriations at all?
There were, but I wouldn't say it was easy, because there was barbed wire all around the camp. So, you know, that area of Stanley, the Stanley Peninsula, which included St. Stephen's College and the prison, and not much else, was kind of, you know, was closely guarded by sentries, barbed wire, and so on. And also, it's very difficult for a European to escape from an Asian prison camp, because you obviously stand out as a European. And remember, in Hong Kong, during the period of occupation, most of the Europeans have been interned. Of course, there were Germans, other nationalities that were not Italians, and others who were not considered enemy civilians. But nevertheless, the prospect of escaping, I mean, where do you escape to? You know, you're on the island.
I guess, it doesn't matter how well you know Hong Kong, with a white face in the middle of a war.
That's a problem.
You can't melt away, can you?
Yeah. But nevertheless, people did manage. In the military POW camps, there were quite a large number of escapes, remarkably, in the first 6 months of military internment. In the civilian camp, there were really only two escapes by seven people. The first escape was by a lady, called Gwen Priestwood, and a police officer who one night slipped under the wire, got down to the road that led to Stanley Fort, walked along the shore at night, went up onto the battlegrounds, the hills behind Stanley, and eventually made it to the north shore of the island. Stanley's on the south side of the island. So they make it to the north shore, probably somewhere around Shao Kei Wan. And they managed to persuade a junk captain to take them across the harbour. So they get across the harbour. They're helped by Chinese communist guerrillas. And they make their way to that part of Free China closest to Hong Kong. And again, surprisingly, there was a city in China called Wei Chow, which was part of Free China, not occupied by the Japanese, and only 70 miles from Hong Kong. But that, you know, that distance had to be accomplished largely on foot. Or boat along rivers for part of the way.
In terms of, so most of the Europeans were interned. The people who weren't, what is life like for the inhabitants of Hong Kong under occupation? I'm thinking of things like, are there air raids?
There were air raids, but they didn't really start immediately. The first air raids took place in October 1942. So that's 10 months after the surrender. And then there was a bit of a hiatus in air raids. But by 1944, they're very frequent. And in 1945, there are masses of them.
Yeah.
And in fact, on one of these air raids on 16th of January, 1945, there were over 100 aircraft involved, something like 138 in the morning and 158 aircraft in the afternoon. And most of the air raids were carried out by the US Army Air Force operating from China. But on that particular date, 16th of January, the US Navy joined the air raids on Hong Kong. And this was the first time that the US Army Air Force and the US Navy had attacked at the same time.
Because they don't, there is no US Air Force till, is it 47? So it's.
There is no US Air Force, only the US Army Air Force, who fly different types of aircraft. Mm. They're flying B-24s, Liberators, B-25s, and they have Mustangs as escort aircraft for their bombers, Warhawks, whereas the US Navy are using different aircraft, smaller aircraft, Helldivers, Avengers, Hellcats, and they come from this massive fleet, an armada of ships operating in the South China Sea. But unfortunately, the US Army Air Force and the US Navy didn't talk to each other. So they didn't know they were both conducting a raid at the same time. And the US Army Air Force were being briefed by British military intelligence. So they were told where the, you know, where the prisoner of war camps were, where the internment camps were. The US Navy had no idea where, which ones were POW camps or internment camps. So unfortunately, on that particular day, Stanley internment camp was accidentally bombed by US Navy aircraft, and 14 civilians in one of the former staff bungalows were killed in an air raid. And meanwhile, the air raids were aimed at ports, infrastructure, and very often the shelling, the bombing went wide. So there were large numbers of civilian casualties, collateral damage. So it was very, I mean, the air raids were very terrifying when they occurred, but they also kind of provided hope for prisoners in the POW camps. They provided a huge morale boost. They could hardly contain their excitement. And even in Stanley, although it was scary and people did die, generally, that it, you know, it was a matter of huge excitement seeing these things and realizing that the end of the war was coming.
So can you talk us through how Hong Kong was actually liberated and what was the atmosphere like once liberation actually came?
Well, I suppose it all started with a B-29 flying over Hiroshima and dropping the first atomic bomb, known as Little Boy, from a height of about 31,000 feet to its detonation height of 2,000 feet, exploding over the city. Truman sends a message to the emperor and government of Japan that they must surrender now or face a rain of fire, the like of which has never been seen before. But the Japanese are in no hurry to surrender, despite the incredible damage and number of deaths caused by the first atomic bomb. The second atomic bomb, a few days later, Hiroshima is hit on 6th of August, 1945. On the 9th of August, Nagasaki is bombed. And at about the same time, Russia, rather opportunistically, declares war on Japan, and the Russian army advances at lightning speed across northern China and a province known as Manchuria, occupied by the Japanese. But even then, the war council is split and the military men don't want to surrender. But it was these things that led to the surrender, the Russian declaration of war, the two atomic bombs. And the Japanese had no idea how many atomic bombs the Americans had. Actually, there were very few, and it would have taken a long time to build more. But on the 15th of August, the emperor makes a speech broadcast on radio. His troops are all lined up all over the captured territories in the Far East and in the home islands in Japan. They're wearing their best uniform. They're wearing white gloves. And they're listening for the first time, to the voice of their emperor. And their emperor is seen as a kind of divinity, a godlike being.
Yeah.
He speaks in the ornate language of the court, a language and an accent that is sort of unfamiliar. But he's asking them to do the unthinkable. The enemy has developed a new weapon. We must suffer the unsufferable. He didn't like to use the word surrender, but they used the words, they will accept the demands set out in the Potsdam Declaration, which called for unconditional surrender. So the Royal Navy is taken a bit by surprise by the rapidity of the Japanese surrender. The main Royal Navy Pacific Fleet is down at the Admiralty Islands in a place called Manus Island near Papua New Guinea. And they're quite a long way from Hong Kong. So they've got to steam up to Hong Kong. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, there's a question, for the Japanese, who's it going to be returned to? Is it going to go to the Americans, who aren't very keen on the idea of British continuing with their colonies? Is it going to be returned to Britain, to whom it belonged before the war began? Or is it going to go to the nationalist Chinese, to Chiang Kai-shek? The Royal Navy steam up to the Philippines. By the 29th of August, their fleet is standing off Hong Kong. And of course, another large element of the fleet is progressing towards Japan.
It's on Philip, the 30th, isn't it? On HMS Welk, because he witnesses the surrender on Tokyo Bay, doesn't he?
Yeah, he was there. And actually, oddly enough, so was my dad. My dad was not on that ship. He was on another destroyer, HMS Undaunted. And he was in Tokyo Bay at the time of the surrender, and had been part of the Pacific Fleet involved in supporting the American landings at Okinawa and Iwo Jima and so on. But anyway, the Royal Navy, or that part of the Pacific Fleet that had been designated with the role of repossessing Hong Kong, entered the harbour on 30th of August 1945. And it was like Hong Kong was a ghost town. There was such a shortage of everything during the occupation. There were no cars, there were few trams, most people walked, there was no electricity. The population had been reduced from about 1.6 million to only 500,000. The population consisted of people who were emaciated, ghostly figures. It was like entering a ghost town. And the Royal Navy came in with they had two aircraft carriers, a battleship, two cruisers, and an array of destroyers and minesweepers. So they enter the harbour somewhat cautiously, but with aircraft, Hellcats from the Navy carriers, flying almost at rooftop height. Their job was basically to create shock and awe, to impress the Japanese. So the aircraft is zooming in at rooftop height, zooming over the harbour, erupting up into the skies, and the warships. The admiral in charge, Rear Admiral Harcourt, has transferred his flag from the carrier Indomitable to the cruiser Swiftsure, and immediately they start tying up on the Kowloon side of Hong Kong and on the island side. And they send landing parties ashore. They start rustling up the Japanese. And after a while, the prisoners of war are released. The Japanese are interned. There's about 9,000 of them. And over a matter of weeks, the prisoners of war are sent home, both the civilian internees and the military POWs.
It's just, what do you think the legacy of the Second World War is for Hong Kong?
I think, you know, when the governor in Hong Kong during the time of the battle was a chap called Smart Young. So he was governor and commander in chief. He'd already started to do quite a bit of work in terms of dealing with corruption, which was quite rife in Hong Kong before the war. And he'd also started to do something towards creating a more diverse society. Before the war, Hong Kong was not exactly diverse. There were so many glass ceilings. If you happened to be Chinese or Indian or Portuguese or from the wrong social class, there were all kinds of glass ceilings that were difficult to get through. Some of the Chinese businessmen had prospered and created big companies. But it wasn't a very fair society. So when the governor, who'd been imprisoned throughout the war, he returned to Hong Kong in, I think it was around May 1946. Up until that time, Hong Kong had been run by a British military administration. Mm-hmm. But when the new governor came in, he started to create a more democratic form of government in Hong Kong. This wasn't really appreciated by the colonial office in London. And so Sir Mark Young only lasted 1 year and was then replaced by a more conservative governor and commander-in-chief. What the legacy is, hard to say. I mean, I suppose the liberation ensured that Hong Kong came back to British rule rather than American, rather than nationalist Chinese. So, you know, the legacy, the visible legacy that one sees today is the military cemeteries at Stanley and Saiwan, the rows of neat Commonwealth War Grave Commission tombstones. Another legacy, again, in terms of visibility, is all the pillboxes in the New Territories along the so-called Gin Drinkers Line and the pillboxes around the beaches of Hong Kong Island. Even the batteries, there are gun batteries still there. All the emplacements are still there. You can even find the trenches are still there. You can even, on some of the battlefields, when I first used to go out to explore the battlefields of Hong Kong, you could pick up bullets. You could see grenades lying on the ground, live grenades, and shells, bullets, bits of uniform, steel helmets, rifles, even aircraft, crashed aircraft. And a lot of this still remains a kind of reminder of the past, a visible legacy.
Philip, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about Hong Kong and the Second World War. I never come out of one of these Far East World War II episodes without feeling completely traumatised. But we do absolutely need to cover it. So thank you for coming on and giving us such a comprehensive picture of Hong Kong under occupation. We will absolutely put the book in the History Hack bookshop, buy it from us, because then independent bookshops get a cut, Philip gets a cut, we get a cut, and Amazon get nothing, which we like.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come on your show.
Pleasure.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.